Chapter 18, Profile. On the ceiling of the Vatican's Sistine Chapel, God reaches out to Adam in what's probably the most famous image of the biblical deity in Western art. Rippling with muscle and surrounded by a gaggle of golden-haired angels and rosy-cheeked putti, God is the all-powerful cosmic creator, sweeping through the heavenly skies to bless his new-made mortal with a touch of his finger. There are silver streaks in his pale grey hair and frost-white curls in his cloud-coloured beard. Deep creases line his forehead and wrinkles crinkle around his eyes. This is a god older than the universe. Of course, when he painted the creation of Adam in the early 16th century, Michelangelo was far from the first to imagine God in this way. The Western god had already been cast as the white-haired sovereign elder of the cosmos because this was precisely the way he was portrayed in a highly influential passage in the 2nd century BCE Book of Daniel, giving rise to a wealth of early Jewish and Christian literature featuring an aged patriarchal deity enthroned at the apex of a multi-tiered heaven crowded with angels and archangels. But when God's hair first turned white in the Book of Daniel, it signalled his holiness as much as his age. Throughout the first millennium BCE, the dazzling light emanating from Yahweh's body had manifested his innate purity as well as his divine radiance. Simply put, he was sparkling clean. In his temples, Yahweh's presence imparted the same purity to the space itself, hence the need to keep temples richly clean of the polluting dirt of religious malpractice and spiritual impiety. But in the mid-2nd century BCE, the temple in Jerusalem was defiled by Antiochus IV Epiphanes, a Hellenistic king of the Seleucid Empire under whose control the Levant had fleetingly fallen. Antiochus not only helped himself to the temple treasury, but reputedly appointed a deeply unpopular high priest, installed a statue of Zeus in Yahweh's sanctuary, and offered sacrifices to him there. It was a short-lived measure, for Antiochus would soon be dead, killed by disease or war in 164 BCE, and Jerusalem's temple would be purged of its trespassing Greek god. But this was the defiling horror the biblical book of Daniel sought in part to address. Composed shortly after Antiochus's incursion into the temple, the book's eponymous, legendary hero is cast as the visionary who foresees the punishment of Antiochus and his horde of dirty foreigners, who are collectively presented as a ravenous, rampaging chaos monster equipped with iron teeth and 11 horns, the last of which, Antiochus himself, has human eyes and a mouth speaking arrogantly. Daniel is transported to the heavenly throne room, where he witnesses God decreeing the execution of the monstrous foe, which is promptly killed and set alight, before a younger divine figure in human form, one like a son of man, rides in on the clouds of heaven to be given eternal kingship over all peoples. It's a cataclysmic end-of-times vision, which promises the cosmos will be made anew. But in the face of such defiling monstrosity and urgent cosmic reordering, God himself remains the picture of perpetual purity. Enthroned in fiery splendour and surrounded by thousands of divine courtiers, he is called an Ancient of Days, dressed in robes white as snow, with hair like lamb's wool. These verses conjure an image of a primordial, white-haired sovereign of the universe, directing the end-of-times events Daniel witnesses. Underlying this biblical vision was a much older, long-lived mythic image of the aged high god Ael, who had granted the young cloud rider, Baal, kingship in the heavens. In the Ugaritic myths, El's status as the oldest of the gods was corporeally conveyed by the greyness of his hair and beard, a colour serving as a symbol of perpetuity rather than a sign of physical degeneration. To his daughter Anat, Ael's grey hair and beard represented the very authority she sometimes sought to challenge. "I shall strike the top of your skull," she screams at Ael, albeit from a prudent distance. "I shall make your grey hair run with blood, the grey hair of your beard with gore." to Ael's chief wife, Etherat, his long grey beard sitting on his chest manifested the hoary wisdom of experience. The greyness of your beard indeed makes you wise, the compassion from your breast indeed instructs you, she tells him. No wonder Ael was known as the Father of Years, a title which spoke as much to his time-free, eternal nature as to his seniority. As the younger gods themselves declared, Ael was the ageless one who begot us. In ancient Israel and Judah, Yahweh had gradually usurped Ael's status as the high god of the cosmos and taken his titles for himself. By the time the Book of Genesis had been compiled, sometime in the 5th century BCE, Yahweh had already been called Ael the Everlasting. Poets had declared no end to his years and that their number was simply unsearchable. Now, in the 2nd century BCE, Yahweh was the Ancient of Days, whose hair and beard had acquired the greyness of Ael's own, his radiant purity rendering it a dazzling white. The changing face of the biblical God inevitably raised questions for early Jewish scholars. Had their ancestors encountered God as a beautiful youth, a fearsome warrior, or a wise old man? For many rabbis, the answer lay hidden in plain sight in their holy scrolls. In the Pasikta to Rav Kahana, a collection of Midrashic traditions dated to the 3rd to 5th centuries CE, these old scriptural proofs were laid bare. Alluding to key biblical verses, including those describing the beautiful male lover in the Solomonic Song of Songs and the Ancient of Days in the Book of Daniel, the Midrash explains how God could appear in many modes and yet remain unchangingly constant. The Holy One, blessed may he be, appeared to them in the sea like a warrior conducting a war. He revealed himself to them at Sinai like a scribe who teaches the Torah, and he appeared to them in the time of Daniel like an old man who teaches the Torah. He appeared to them in the time of Solomon like a young man. The Holy One, blessed may he be, said to them, "It is not that you deserve to see me in different forms, but it is I who was in the sea, it is I who was at Sinai, for I am the Lord thy God." For these rabbis, God was able to change his appearance at will, but not because he was like those shapeshifters of Greek and Roman myth, nor because he was a polymorphic phantasm like Jesus, whose own followers had struggled to recognize him after his miraculous resurrection. Rather, the rabbis argued, the aesthetics of God's form were innately bound to the specifics of his revelatory performance. When he fought to liberate his people from Egypt, he was a youthful warrior. When he instructed his people in the Torah on Sinai, he was a wise old teacher. Just as the Romans themselves celebrated the young man who conducted himself as an experienced elder and the old man who displayed a youthful verve, so too the rabbis vaunted their unchanging God for his capacity for apparent paradox. The aged Torah scribe at Sinai was as youthfully vigorous as a warrior, while the young warrior who fought at the sea was as sage as an elderly scholar. It was a rabbinic position carefully explicated to allay any suggestion that the Jewish God was either subject to the ravages of time, or that he was not even one God at all, but two. These were understandable anxieties. The image of God as the white-haired Ancient of Days had already found a place in much earlier Jewish traditions about the legendary Enoch, who had ascended into the heavens and been transformed into a celestial scribe. And by the 1st century CE, Enoch had been elevated further still in status. It was said that when he had ascended to heaven, he was not simply one looking like a son of man or a human, but the Son of Man, a divine figure on whom the white-haired high god conferred cosmic kingship. There came out of that house in heaven Michael and Gabriel and Raphael and Phanuel and many holy angels without number, and with them was the head or Ancient of Days, and his head was white and pure as wool, and his garments were indescribable. And he came to me and greeted me with his voice and said to me, "You are that Son of Man who was born for righteousness, and righteousness dwells on you, and the righteousness of the head or Ancient of Days will not forsake you." In this collection of visions in 1 Enoch, the eponymous seer not only learns that he is the divine Son of Man, but foresees his enthronement in the heavens alongside God, where he'll preside over the last judgment at the end of times. No wonder some rabbis of the early centuries of the Common Era felt the need to assert the oneness of God. At the same time, of course, they were also contending with the very similar claims many Jews and Gentiles had been making about Jesus. In various early Christian writings, some of which would come to be canonical, Jesus was said to have identified himself as the Son of Man, who would ascend to his divine Father on lightning-lit storm clouds, where he would be enthroned in the heavens at God's right hand, oversee the last judgment, and be given an eternal kingdom. As the heavenly Son of Man, Christ was given the white wool hair and dazzling face of a divinity, aligning him in look and function with God himself, as the book of Revelation illustrates. "I saw one like the Son of Man, clothed with a long robe and with a golden sash across his chest. His head and his hair were white as white wool, white as snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire, and his face was like the sun shining with full force." As these traditions indicate, Daniel's vision of the white-haired Ancient of Days and the Son of Man was easily transposed onto the theological distinction between God the Father and his divine Son, while at the same time suggesting the two were to be closely identified. "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end," the eternal God declares from his throne towards the end of Revelation, only for the same claim to be made by Christ at the book's close. "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end." For the writer of this influential early Christian work, God and his Son were presented as identical in looks and equals in power. An early Christian insistence upon the visual likeness of the Son to his Father was similarly expressed in what appears to have been formulaic or ritual confessions of faith. "Though he was in the form of God, he did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited," sang some. "He has spoken to us by a Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom he also created the worlds. He is the reflection of God's glory and the exact imprint of God's very being," intoned others. As early as these ideas were, portrayals of a cosmic Christ in the likeness or image of God would take some time to filter into the visual cultures of his early devotees. The earliest identifiable Christian art is attested in the catacombs of Rome from the beginning of the 3rd century CE, the house church in the eastern Syrian town of Gyra Europus, mid-3rd century, and on decorated Roman sarcophagi of the 3rd and 4th centuries. These works usually depict Christ not as a mystical, bright white, heavenly being, nor even as the suffering, crucified Son of God, but as a vivacious, beard-free, and brown-haired Greco-Roman beauty. Whether seated in the authoritative pose of a learned teacher, performing miraculous wonders of healing and magic, or shepherding humanity with a lost lamb upon his shoulders, Christ was initially drawn in the image of youthful deities and semi-divine heroes like Apollo, Dionysus, Hermes, and Orpheus, rather than mirroring the rugged majesty of the thickly bearded high gods like Zeus, Jupiter, Serapis, Asclepius, and Neptune. In some early artworks, depictions of Christ as an orator clutching a scroll would give him the beard of a learned philosopher, as might be seen on depictions of Paul and Peter. But his youthful vigour was still proudly displayed in his athletic body and muscular chest. With the explosion of church building in the 4th century CE came the longer-haired, big-bearded, haloed heavenly Christ with whom we're more familiar. Up until this point, Christian worship had tended to be a relatively low-profile communal activity. Across the Roman Empire, minority religious groups had often been subject to both sporadic and extended periods of persecution, when they might find themselves harassed, arrested, punished, or killed. Ostensibly, these measures were prompted by a refusal to sacrifice to the gods of Rome or a perceived failure to conform to the broader norms of civility. But political machinations were also at work. Since the reign of Diocletian, 284 to 305 CE, Rome's vast empire had been precariously divided between at least two and usually four emperors, each of whom often chose to target or ignore minority groups within their provinces as a part of their wider power play. But in 313 CE, the co-emperors Constantine and Licinius had signed the Edict of Milan, which endorsed, among other things, a more accommodating attitude to Christians and their freedom to worship, and decreed the restitution of their communally owned property. Formally freed from persecution, Christians across the empire refashioned old house churches and new churches sprang up, many financed by Constantine himself. As a worshipper of Christ, Constantine siphoned money from the estates of Greco-Roman temples to construct magnificent Christian basilicas not only in Rome, but in Antioch, Jerusalem, and his new imperial capital, Byzantium, in Latin, Byzantium, which was quickly renamed Constantinople. Local Christian dignitaries east and west increasingly enjoyed the privileges accorded other higher-profile citizens and were soon elevated into positions of civic, administrative, and political power. Life for prominent and ordinary Christians alike became more stable in the care of their churches. Although Christianity would not become the official religion of the Roman Empire until 381 CE, Constantine's policies were continued by all but one of his successors and would have a lasting impact. Favoured with imperial largesse, urban Christianity prospered, and the magnificence of its art reflected this. Out and proud in public buildings, Christ acquired the more classical features of a Mediterranean high god enthroned in splendour. It's a visual shift attested in a mosaic adorning the apse of Santa Prudenziana in Rome, the city's oldest surviving church. Dated to the end of the 4th century, the mosaic shows Christ as Pantocrator, the all-powerful ruler of the universe. Dressed in shimmering robes, he sits on a huge golden throne studded with jewels and lined with scarlet silks. He holds an open book, which is inscribed in Latin with the words, Lord and Preserver of the Church of Prudenziana. Behind him is an enormous golden cross encrusted with precious gemstones. Standing on Golgotha, the hill of Jesus' crucifixion, the cross reaches up into the multicoloured heavens, where God's cherubim gather about it. Here in Santa Prudenziana, Christ has inherited his divine Father's supreme glory and brought the very kingdom of heaven into the church. In some ways, the loftier portrayal of Christ not only reflected his exalted divine status, but also compensated for an absence of images of God himself. In keeping with what was by now a widespread Jewish convention, Christians had tended to avoid figurative images of the deity's face. While God's hand might be seen in Christian art, plunging down from the heavens to direct the action in visual tableaus, his presence was more usually signalled by his cherubim, angels, or a sun chariot hijacked from Helios. In this, Christian visual culture was little different from its Jewish counterparts across the empire, in which God's presence tended to be rendered visible only by means of his hands, a Torah ark, or symbols of the Jerusalem temple, be it a menorah, an altar, or an image of the lost building itself. But whether viewed through a Jewish or Christian lens, God's face persisted in the religious imagination, and by the 4th century CE, it had come to acquire the qualities of a cosmic prototype. Fueled by older traditions about the tangible, transformative impact of seeing God face to face, religious thinkers imagined God's face might not only leave a visible trace on the faces of those exceptional enough to behold him, but on the faces of those spiritually or scripturally equipped to perceive him. Jewish scholars and teachers had long been arguing that the way to truly perceive God was to study the mysteries embedded in the Torah, which is why some of the most beautiful rabbis reportedly had the look of God about them. In a series of Talmudic traditions collated during the 3rd to the 5th centuries CE, the best-looking rabbis across the generations had looked like God himself, for their beauty was ultimately derived from his via Adam and Jacob. The beauty of Rabbi Kahana was like the beauty of Rav. The beauty of Rav was like the beauty of Rabbi Abahu. The beauty of Rabbi Abahu was like the beauty of Father Jacob. The beauty of Father Jacob was like the beauty of Adam. The beauty of Adam was like the beauty of the Divine Presence. Hearing this list, some rabbinic students were perplexed about the absence of another famously beautiful sage, Rabbi Yohanan, until they were reminded that he was beardless and thus rather too feminine and decidedly ungodly in his allure. But another gorgeous teacher would come to be included in this legendary beauty pageant. Rabbi Ishmael ben Elisha HaKohen was reported to have been among 10 sages martyred by Rome, where the flayed skin of his lovely face became a magical relic. Before his death, the rabbi was said to have been taken up to the heavens, where the archangel Gabriel asked him, "Are you the Ishmael in whom the Creator prides himself each day, saying that he has a servant on earth whose looks are like his facial features?" Underscoring all these ancient rabbinic traditions was the biblical insistence that the first man had been created in God's image and likeness, so much so, early rabbis had said, that the angels in Eden were unable to distinguish Adam from his divine creator. The idea that God's face served as a cosmic prototype is a point on which many Christians likely agreed, as one of the earliest identifiably Christian depictions of his face suggests. Dated to the 4th century CE, it's found on a sarcophagus in the Vatican Museum's Pio Cristiano collection. This impressive marble coffin had clearly housed the remains of a wealthy Roman citizen, for its costly friezes are beautifully detailed and exquisitely carved. Like most early Christian funerary art, its focus is the alleviation of earthly ills and the promise of a paradisical post-mortem future, when believers would come face to face with the divine. As such, alongside scenes of a youthful, beardless Christ performing miracles, the sarcophagus offers an image of Eden. Adam and Eve appear either side of the garden's tree, around which is coiled a docile serpent. But Adam's face is turned towards that of a beautifully bearded figure standing next to him. Robed in the long toga of a Roman dignitary, he leans in to Adam, his right hand pressed on Adam's shoulder in a gentle gesture of affectionate blessing. It's God, and his face is identical to Adam's. The first man is God's mirror image. Some scholars have proposed that this scene reflects certain theological claims about the nature of Christ as the incarnate Logos, or Word, of God, through whom the world was created, as the opening verses of the Gospel of John urge its readers to believe. Certainly, prominent theologians of different stripes had repeatedly argued that it was not God the Father who had been with Adam and Eve in Eden, nor God the Father who had appeared to Abraham, Jacob, Moses, and the prophets. Instead, they asserted, it was God the Son in his pre-existent, pre-incarnational state as the divine Logos, who had rendered himself visible to select mortals in the past. This was the Son whom bishops upholding the decisions made at Constantine's Council of Nicaea in 325 CE had subsequently declared to be God from God, light from light, and one substance with the Father. A claim that would have to be formally decreed at the Council of Constantinople in 381 and reasserted again at the Council of Chalcedon in 451, given the strength of ongoing opposition from other theologians. And yet, the extent to which this highbrow esoteric theology might have been either assumed or fully comprehended by even wealthy, reasonably educated Christians of either Jewish or Gentile cultural identity, let alone identified on this marble coffin, is far from certain. After all, the very fact that successive theologians and bishops would still feel the need to insist that it was the pre-incarnate Son and not God the Father whom various biblical figures had seen rather suggests their arguments tended to fall on deaf ears. Instead, it was the deeply ingrained tradition that God had made Adam in his own image and likeness that was more pervasive and persuasive. In the 4th century CE, mourners and pilgrims visiting Rome's Christian cemeteries were already accustomed to seeing Christ as a beardless figure in funerary art, especially when he appeared on sarcophagi. Looking at this particular sarcophagus, they would be far more likely to recognise the figure standing next to Adam simply as God, and to distinguish him from his more youthful, beardless son busily performing wonders in the same frieze. It was God's face that was reflected in Adam's in the Garden of Eden, not Christ's. Another 4th-century sarcophagus in the Vatican Museum's collection similarly displays the prototypical quality of God's face, although this time it's not Adam he looks at. It too is decorated with finely wrought friezes, showcasing snapshots from the life of Jesus, who has the beard-free face of a young man. But at its upper left edge, the creation of Eve is shown. Neatly coiffed and thickly bearded, God sits enthroned, his feet resting on an ornate footstool. Behind him stands another bearded figure, clutching the back of the divine throne. With his curly hair and thick beard, he has the distinct look of God about him. In front of the throne is a third figure who has turned his inquiring face to the deity, appealing for approval. And he too has the face of God. His hand rests on the newly made Eve he has just pulled from Adam's side, who's shown both as a small childlike sleeping figure and as a grown-up dwelling in a verdant paradise. The enthroned God holds up his right hand, his forefingers raised, in a gesture of blessing endorsing the invention of humanity. This is an early figurative representation of the Trinity. It is God the Father who sits enthroned, directing and approving the actions of God the Son as he makes Eve. Looking on is the Holy Spirit, the third member of the Trinity, emanating from the throne, his face turned to the Father and the Son. As the writer of the Epistle to the Hebrews had put it at the end of the 1st century CE, the Son was the reflection of God's glory and the exact imprint of God's very being. Now, on this 4th-century coffin, God's face could be seen imprinted on both the Son and the Spirit. But if their near-identical faces serve to unify the three, their body language implies a hierarchical relationship. The enthroned God enjoys a higher status than his divine companions, while the seemingly privileged attendant position of the Spirit is rendered passive by the creative activity of the Son. Looking at the sarcophagus, it's difficult to decide how we're to understand the divine nature and status of the Son and the Spirit in relation both to each other and to the Father God. In some ways, this striking imagery sums up the theological problems at the heart of Christianity during the first 400 years of the faith. Since the 1st century CE, baptism had been widely accepted as the first crucial step to the believer's eternal salvation, and everyone agreed that Jesus himself had commanded his apostles to baptize in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. This was the threefold formula by which new members continued to be initiated into the faith. But quite what this formula meant was up for debate. Everyone knew the Son and the Holy Spirit were to be identified in some way with God, as the Vatican's Trinity sarcophagus itself illustrates. But there was disagreement about the precise nature of this identification and difficulty in establishing how they each related to one another. By the 4th century, two broad camps had formed. One group tended to emphasize the distinctiveness of Father, Son, and Spirit as three persons, in Greek hypostases, of one God, as a means of explaining the different ways in which God acted within and beyond the created world. But the other group ardently believed this fragmented the oneness of God's nature, his essence or substance, in Greek ousia. And for them, this fragmentation was deeply problematic. It either cast God not as one but three deities, or it subordinated the Son and the Spirit to the Father, relegating their theological roles to glorified assistants to the true God. And yet, in emphasizing the oneness of God, their own position risked casting Father, Son, and Spirit merely as unstable modes or manifestations of God, thereby destabilizing the Father, Son, and Spirit as permanent hypostases of God, those in whose distinct names Jesus had commanded his followers to be baptized. Falling between these camps were various others. Some held the Son and the Spirit were mediators or conduits to the Father, from whom they derived. Some believed the Father and the Son shared the same substance and were equal persons, but the Spirit, though of God, was not equal to the Father and the Son. Others asserted Father, Son, and Spirit all shared the same substance, but still recoiled at describing the Spirit as God. As is so often the case with differences of opinion between Christian groups, the highly creative reinterpretation of Scripture enabled everyone to claim biblical support for their own position, despite the fact that the idea of a triune God appears nowhere in the Jewish scriptures and is staggeringly far from being a solid notion in the writings of the New Testament. A compromise of sorts ostensibly appears to have been reached at the Council of Chalcedon in 451, where, in the course of revisiting the creedal confessions drawn up at Nicaea and Constantinople, it was agreed that Father, Son, and Spirit were one singular, eternal, divine substance and were distinguishable as three persons only by the manner in which each possessed that substance. The Father possessed the divine substance without cause from himself. The Son possessed the divine substance in his being begotten from the Father. And the Spirit possessed the divine substance by proceeding from the Father. The Godhead was one substance and three persons. Ultimately, theologians across the empire had been struggling to reconcile both the early deification of Christ and the divine agency of the Spirit with the ostensibly monotheistic Jewish roots of their faith, headlined by God's own insistence in the scriptures that he was the one and only true God. Despite the expert philosophical craftsmanship of the early church fathers, it was a classic square peg in a round hole dilemma, except there were three pegs of shifting form, shape, and size, and the hole was variously too small, too big, too rigid, or too fragile to hold them all in one place. The rapprochement at Chalcedon would not resolve matters, for Trinitarian disputes continue to dog the faith and divide Christians, and still do today. No matter how the Father, Son, and Spirit were understood to relate to one another in their Trinitarian form, Christ continued to be made in God's image in religious art. And it was in the Roman East that Christ himself would eventually come to be portrayed as the aged, eternal God of the cosmos, complete with the dazzling white hair and hoary white beard of the Ancient of Days. Here, well-established early Christian communities in Asia Minor, Syria, Egypt, and Palestine appear to have adopted the painted wood panel portraits of the young gods and heroes of the older Hellenistic era for their own icons of Christ, as descriptions in early stories about the miraculous healing powers of Christ's picture suggest. The iconography of these portraits would later morph into the familiar face imprinted on famous relics, such as the Mandilion of Edessa, the Handkerchief of Veronica, and the Turin Shroud. But the first portraits of Christ in the Roman East probably looked very much like earlier Hellenistic artworks. Short-haired and beardless, Christ tended to bear the dark good looks and big brown eyes of a more distinctively Middle Eastern or North African man, much like the older funerary portraits of wealthy young men common in Hellenistic Egypt long before the emergence of Christianity. The wood panel portrait was a type of icon that would itself become iconic. As the vast eastern provinces of the Roman Empire gradually transformed into the powerful Byzantine Empire, the artistic conventions of their Christian communities not only swept westwards to colour the visual cultures of late antique and early medieval Europe, but fixed the form of Christian icons as we still find them in Eastern Orthodox churches today. But early examples of these icons are rare. As delicately painted wooden objects, they were prone to damp, damage, and decay, while the aggressive, reactionary iconoclasm of Byzantine emperors in the 8th and 9th centuries would wipe out treasure collections in monasteries and churches across the region. But in the remote, arid environment of St. Catherine's Monastery in Sinai, some remarkable examples have survived, and one in particular attests to a pointedly Eastern Church image of Christ. Measuring a sizeable 76 centimetres in height, the large wooden icon is encased by a thick frame on which a votive declaration is inscribed. For the salvation and pardon of the sins of your servant Philochristos. Enthroned on a rainbow amid a galaxy of stars, Christ wears the golden robes of majesty, his sandaled feet resting on an orb, a pre-Christian emblem of overarching heavenly power. His head is crowned with a golden halo encircled by a red-hot beam of light, and the divine name Emmanuel, spelled out in golden Greek letters, hovers next to him. His right hand is authoritatively raised, and his left holds an open, golden-leaved book, in which traces of the words, "I am the light of the world," have been detected. He is surrounded by a mandorla, around which two of an original four cherubim discreetly hover against the thick golden light enshrining his presence. This is Christ's Pantocrator, but unlike his darker-haired manifestation in Western iconography of the age, his youthful face is adorned with the white hair and white beard of the supreme God of the heavens. Although the icon tends to be dated to the late 6th or early 7th century, its sophisticated imagery and expert execution suggest it's of a pre-existing type rather than a newfangled experimental genre. And the theological heft of the icon would support this. The conflation of imagery and inscriptions in this icon points to several biblical motifs on which his iconology of Christ has been drawn. The white-haired deity is the aged Ancient of Days from the Book of Daniel. His rainbow is ultimately taken from Ezekiel's vision of God enthroned above the cherubim. And the Greek inscription, Emmanuel, God is with us, names the divinely promised baby born to a young woman in the book of Isaiah. But this is not a heavy-handed pick-and-mix theology. Instead, it's a graphic reflection of more complex ideas about the divine nature of Christ filtered through the lens of the book of Revelation, in which he's given the white hair of God the Father. On this icon, Christ himself is the Ancient of Days. He is God himself, the eternal ruler of the universe, who was made flesh and born of the Virgin. "For my sake, the Ancient of Days has become a babe," worshippers in the Eastern Church of the period sang in celebration of the Incarnation. "Today, the Ancient of Days, he that once gave the law of Mount Sinai to Moses, is seen as a babe." In the Latin West, the aged features of the Ancient of Days tended to be reserved for images of God the Father rather than Christ. But in the old library of Saint-Lucepin, a village in the Jura region of France, there was found a remarkable image of Christ on the cover of a gospel book. The book itself dates to the 9th century CE, but the ivory panels serving as its front and back covers were once a Byzantine diptych, which was probably made in Constantinople in the 5th or 6th century CE. Surrounded by scenes from legends about Jesus, Mary and the saints, the centrepiece on one of the panels shows Christ seated on an ornate throne, his feet on a pretty footstool. His right hand is raised in a gesture of blessing, while in his left he holds up a book emblazoned with a cross. Behind him, looking over his shoulders, are Peter and Paul. Despite their cropped pudding bowl hairstyles, they are elderly men with wrinkled foreheads and bushy beards. And so too is Christ. Hunched in his chair, he has the loose pot belly of an old man. His face is lined with age, his cheeks have sagged into jowls, and his long, almost scraggy beard sits on his chest. There is no trace of Christ the divine Son. He has become the Ancient of Days in form as well as name. Like the high god Ael of the very distant past, whose own grey beard rested on his chest when he put his feet up on a footstool, Christ is the aged god of the cosmos, and it shows. This was an iconology of Christ distinct to the Byzantine world, and it persists today in Eastern Orthodox churches where occasionally images of a white-haired heavenly Christ are still made in the likeness of his father. By contrast, the Western churches of late antiquity preferred to cast God the Father as the eternal white-haired patriarch of the cosmos. So pervasive was this Western tendency that by the 10th century CE, the God of the Bible had become the old man of the universe with whom we're so familiar. From the delicate deity gracing the pages of early medieval illuminated manuscripts to Michelangelo's muscular creator whirling in the clouds in the Sistine Chapel, God's snow-white hair and bleach-bright beard would be forever fixed in the religious imagination.